This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. So we are here and ready to discuss the important events of this week with our panel, and we are glad you have joined us here in the studio. We have Jeremiah Jacques.
Hello there.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And from our office in Jerusalem, Brent Nachtigall.
Shalom.
We just sent the newest Trumpet edition to press, the November-December 2018 edition. The cover headline is "A House Divided Against Itself Cannot Stand," showing a torn American flag depicting the division in America that is dangerously deep right now. We have a couple of stories later on in the program about that. The cover story of this issue from Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flory is "The Kavanaugh Hearings Reveal America's Lawless Spirit," with the subhead, "The Appalling Battle Over the United States Supreme Court Shows How Close This Nation Is to Collapse and How God Will Solve the Problem." So this story will be on the website, onthetrumpet.com, next week. You can stay tuned, watch for that. And again, we'll get to some of that later in the program, including at the end of the program, some discussion on these pipe bombs that have been showing up at the offices of prominent Democrats in America. But first, we're going to take a look at some other news around the world that happened this week, starting in the Middle East. We've been following Iran's increased belligerence quite closely, and this week we saw more troubling evidence of its expanding offensive against Israel. For this story, we'll turn to Brent.
According to United States intelligence reports, this was actually at the end of last week, just after we recorded the program, so I couldn't speak about it. But Fox News had an exclusive based on reports from the United States that Iran had supplied Hezbollah with equipment to upgrade its missiles with precision guidance, making them precision guidance munitions. Basically, they are going to be able to retrofit their missiles with some GPS technology, and this is quite dangerous, obviously, for Israel, just in terms of how many missiles Hezbollah has in their possession. I don't know, and it's uncertain how many of those 120 to 150,000 missiles can be retrofitted with this GPS technology, but certainly Israel is worried that a lot of them can. Now, according to this report that Fox had, they followed a Boeing 747, possibly cargo plane, that they've been tracking this plane basically for the past year. But on October 16th, it landed. So this is 2 weeks ago now, landed at the Beirut airport from Damascus and then originally from Tehran. It was there for a couple of hours in Beirut, offloaded cargo, which was, according to the report, these the equipment from Iran to help make these missiles more accurate, and then it flew to Qatar and then back to Tehran. And this is the third trip that this specific plane has made to Beirut from Iran in the last few months. And so we've talked a lot about what Israel does to prevent Hezbollah from getting weaponry from Iran across the overland route through Syria. And Israel has conducted over 200 strikes, 200 separate military strikes in the past year and a half at those convoys and weapons depots in Syria to prevent those weapons coming across to Hezbollah. But Israel hasn't blown the 747 out of the sky, not that we know of. And so this plane is obviously offloading important cargo to be used by Hezbollah.
So, well, tell us about this cargo and how they have a sense of what it is exactly and what this would mean in terms of upgrading capability for Hezbollah.
So we kind of knew that that Iran had this ability to retrofit missiles that are already in existence with this kind of this seeker technology. They've been doing it with their own. And Hezbollah themselves reported a couple of weeks ago, Nasrallah, the leader of Hezbollah, saying that they have the precision capabilities, that they're actually making it themselves. That's what he said. And that they have the ability to strike. Oh, no. Then Netanyahu came out a month and a half ago and said that Hezbollah now has the ability to strike anywhere within Israel, within about 10 meters. And so this is before, when Hezbollah in the Second Lebanon War is firing all their missiles southward, they didn't have guidance systems on them. They weren't accurate. Mm-hmm. And so Israel can deploy, you know, its Iron Dome system or the David Sling system to try and shoot out these missiles out of the sky. The way that that system works, that defensive system works, is it basically picks whether or not the missiles are going to hit a populated center. If they're deemed threatening, then it will send off a missile and try to intercept it, at which point it's 85 to 90% accurate. But that's based on the fact that only about a quarter of the missiles that they fire are deemed to be threatening. And so if Hezbollah, and then maybe perhaps even Hamas eventually, gets this technology, it could convert every single one of those missiles to being threatening. And that would completely overload Israel's ability to destroy these missiles in the air through David Sling and the Iron Dome system. And so this is worrying for Israel. Certain commentators have spoke about the tense situation between Hamas and Israel and how it almost went to a war, but that Israel dialed it back because they were worried that Hezbollah would then join the fight, and that Israel doesn't have the defensive capabilities to station their Iron Domes on Gaza, and then their anti-missile technology at Gaza, and then at the Northern Front as well. And so Israel basically dialed back, this is what some commentators are saying, dialed back their attack on Gaza because they're worried about Hezbollah's recent capabilities.
So can you put this in the context of the other moves that Iran has made, and just what does this tell us about Iranian strategy?
Well, we did talk even on last week's Week in Review about that piece in the Jerusalem Post that revealed that, contrary to a lot of Western reports, Iran really is dedicated to its cause of destroying Israel. And this week, this was only one of the stories that came out. Mm-hmm. There was another couple. There was one just yesterday that showed that Hezbollah is now setting up shop about 3 kilometers from the border between Israel and Syria. The Hezbollah is obviously in Syria as well, supporting Assad. And so they're actually got observation posts there at this time, and they're probably going to increase their pressure from that direction as well. And then there's another report about how Iraq has, through the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, they now have the ability to produce and manufacture missiles there that could target Israel as well. So that would be another front that Israel would be facing if Iran chose to mobilize them. And so you have all these proxies now in Iraq, in Syria, in Gaza, in southern Lebanon, where Iran has basically, if it wants to, can tell them all at once, yes, fire your missiles at Israel. And this is something that could be devastating to Israel because it doesn't have the defenses to cope with that. Mm-hmm. So in terms of Bible prophecy, we have spoken at length about how Iran does have this desire to conquer Jerusalem and to destroy the state of Israel. We've been writing about that Mr. Gerald Flurry, our editor-in-chief, has written about that in his booklet, The King of the South, and also his booklet, Jerusalem in Prophecy, noting that Iran is the largest state sponsor of terrorism, and a lot of the money that it sponsors to sponsor terrorism is directed towards the Israelis. And the Bible indicates that they are going to push so hard with this current offensive that Palestinians backed by Iran are actually going to gain control of half of Jerusalem. And so that's where this is leading. These type of news reports are leading to Iran's increased presence inside Israel. The chief of Mossad said that this week. He said that if the Fatah leader Mahmoud Abbas dies, we've got to watch out for Iran to start mobilizing in the West Bank. which borders on East Jerusalem, obviously. And so Israeli leadership is concerned about this, and this is something the Bible prophecy says actually will happen.
Yeah, we definitely appreciate you bringing that to us, Brent. It's very intriguing to hear this and all of these headlines that you're talking about, the one that you highlighted among a batch of stories about Iran's activities. In light of everything that we've been hearing in the United States this week has been about the pressure that people have been putting on the president to cut ties with Saudi Arabia or start sanctioning Saudi Arabia because of that horrific murder that took place in Turkey. But it does seem like the president has a pretty clear eye on what the most important threat in the region is, and his Saudi Arabia policy is definitely calibrated to deal with exactly these threats that you're talking about. It is important to make sure that we see all of these events in the big picture, and when you put it in the context of prophecy the way that you had, it does give us a very clear picture of what's going on there. So we do thank you very much for that. That is just something that is unique to the view that we have. It does give us that perspective that we need on those events. We appreciate that. We'll go now to Asia, turning to Jeremiah Jacques, who took the Wednesday program on Trumpet Hour, an excellent program about famine. I would encourage you to go and listen to that. And thank you very much, Jeremiah, for taking that. Very good job there. A major engineering achievement in China this past week demonstrates not only that nation's industrial capacity, but also its geopolitical ambitions. So for this story, we'll turn to Jeremiah.
Yep, China this week unveiled the world's longest sea-crossing bridge ever built. This bridge spans more than 34 miles, and it connects mainland China with both Macau and Hong Kong. It's called the Hong Kong-Zhuhai-Macau Bridge. And it cost about $20 billion. It took almost a decade to build, and it contains as much steel as would be in 60 Eiffel Towers. Mm. So it really is just a marvel of engineering. It's built to withstand earthquakes up to 8.0 magnitude and typhoons of all kinds. And there's one section of this bridge, it's about 4 miles long, that actually dips undersea into a tunnel just to allow ships to pass by overhead in a really busy shipping lane there. There's also a beautifully engineered merging point that switches the traffic to the other lane, because Hong Kong and Macau both follow the British tradition of driving on the left while mainland China drives on the right. So this bridge factors that in and allows them to change to the other side there. There are also artificial islands incorporated into the design, and it's a 6-lane superhighway. So it really is just an amazing showpiece of Chinese innovation and engineering capacity.
So, but this is about more than just the innovation and the engineering. This also, the fact that it's connecting the specific points that it is, tells us a lot about China's geopolitical ambitions.
That's exactly right. It's an undeniable symbol of Beijing's increasingly just ambitious geopolitical goals. And I think that we can view this bridge the way many people in Hong Kong do, which is just as a physical manifestation of China's resolve to tighten its control on Hong Kong and on the South China Sea and on Macau and beyond. It was about 21 years ago now that Great Britain handed Hong Kong over to China. And most of the people in Hong Kong were very uneasy about that transition. Most of these people were either people who had fled the communist mainland to live under British rule as refugees, or descendants of those people. So they were understandably worried that with that handover, China would begin to kind of remove all of the cherished freedoms and all of the distinctive identity, really, that Hong Kong had that differentiated it from the rest of China. But China promised that Hong Kong would stay highly autonomous for at least 50 years. They said for that time, the Hong Kong individuals would be able to just maintain their economic policies and basically call the shots for themselves and let their basic law, which is their, it's kind of like a miniature constitution, let that govern them. And in the early years, China kept that promise. But within just a few short years, signs emerged showing that China had no real intention of allowing Hong Kong to be autonomous for that full duration. The Chinese began insisting that Hong Kong be governed only by leaders who were pro-China. And they even, in 2014, the Chinese came out and said, okay, for your next election for the highest civil office in the Hong Kong government, you guys can vote, but you can only vote by candidates that Beijing has pre-approved. So that's, you know, that's democracy with Chinese characteristics, which is right. Not actually democracy at all.
Right.
And also around that time, Chinese agents began abducting many Hong Kongese who didn't toe the Communist Party line, including one of the territory's most powerful billionaires. He's just been MIA for 3 or 4 years now. So the people of Hong Kong protested many of these developments, but nothing ever came of it. And it became clear that Beijing would not budge and that China was the only actual authority in Hong Kong. And so it's clear to everyone now that the cherished freedoms that Hong Kong long had are disintegrating. And with this new bridge now providing China just one more powerful way to assert control over Hong Kong, more and more analysts are wondering how long it'll be before this territory is fully assimilated into the authoritarian mainland.
Yeah. Well, you have an article on thetrumpet.com and a video that's getting ready to go up. China unveils world's longest sea bridge, tightening Beijing's grip on Hong Kong. And you bring out the point in there about just how you can't view what's happened here without thinking about how this does represent the end result of that loss of a seagate on Britain's part, something that was specifically prophesied. And at the time that Britain turned Hong Kong over to China, we talked specifically and pointed to that prophecy that describes this. And it does really show the direction that you see away from American and British control and toward these Gentile powers.
That's exactly right. I think some of the most astounding prophecies in the Bible about the end time United States and Great Britain are some of those in Genesis. Genesis 22:17 specifically says that the descendants of Israel, which are the United States and Britain predominantly, would come to possess the sea gates that allow control over so many vital shipping lanes and just other parts of the oceans. And Mr. Gerald Fleury, the editor-in-chief of The Trumpet, brought this out in a 2016 article about the South China Sea, and he specifically mentions Hong Kong being handed over to the Chinese from the British as fulfilling a second prophecy in Deuteronomy 28:52, which says after the U.S. and the U.K. would come to control those gates, they would later lose control of them. Mm-hmm. They would see them handed over to antagonistic nations. And so Mr. Fleury said that handover really was a fulfillment of that prophecy there. And it also allows China to tighten its control over the South China Sea. Hong Kong really is kind of it allows access to the South China Sea. It's right there at the confluence of the Pacific and the South China Sea. So it's a powerful article that puts this into kind of a prophetic and a geopolitical context.
And the title of that article?
China is steering the world toward war.
Okay, well, we'll put a link to that in the show notes, as well as this article from Jeremiah about China unveiling the world's longest sea bridge. Go check that out, and you can understand why we're watching this with such interest and how it fulfills these prophecies. We appreciate that, Jeremiah. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our week in review program on 101.3 KPCG. If you've followed the trumpet for any length of time, you know we point to the prophecy of Daniel 2 for insight into developing European unification. It describes this political experiment as a mixture of iron and clay, a mixture that doesn't stick together very well. Internal strife in the European Union is very common, and this week we saw some more of it. For this story, we'll go to our man in Britain, Richard Palmer.
Yes, today I'd like to talk about Italy, or perhaps as we should call it, Quitaly. There's a lot of tension between Italy and the European Commission right now. Italy, they published their budget recently where they put forward, this is how much money we want to spend, this is how much money we want to bring in taxes, this is how much money we want to borrow. And then the European Commission said no. They looked at their budget and they told Italy, this budget is unacceptable, you're borrowing too much money, you can't do that. And now this is causing quite the impasse in Europe. It's going to be a bit of a slow rolling process because everything here takes several weeks of discussion and backwards and forwards. But it's one of the biggest obstacles the euro has hit, because on the one hand, all these countries share a currency. And that can only work if one country can't just go debt crazy, if you can have a way of preventing one country going debt crazy, borrowing tons of money, and then crashing the whole system.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, though, the Europe doesn't really have a good way of forcing Italy to comply. They can restrict what money the EU gives Italy. But Italy is a net contributor to the EU. It pays in more than it pays out, and it could just say, fine, we're just not giving you the money in the first place. And so it's causing this standoff and this impasse at the European level. Europe says, no, they're not backing down. Italy isn't backing down. And it's anybody's guess exactly how that plays out, where that goes. But it really does expose this half-finished nature of the European project.
Yes.
We're seeing this showdown now of Italy versus Germany. Some people are saying Germany's the more powerful one. They're going to be able to crush Italy. Other people are saying, well, no, in this circumstance, Italy has the more power. In the grand scheme of things, it doesn't matter. It just shows that Europe's current system is dysfunctional. And right. It leads to these kind of conflicts with debtor nations squaring off about against creditor nations and all of this just kind of these roadblocks. And so what you're seeing now is Europe start to be confronted with this fact that the way they're set up right now doesn't work. Well, they've been very, very good at finding sticking plasters for this problem, piping over these fundamental contradictions, kicking the can down the road for a couple of years. They did that in Greece. They've done that with Spain and Italy and come up with these temporary solutions. With Portugal, Ireland, these temporary solutions. The situation in Italy, that's going to be much harder. Italy just has way more debt than Greece. It's way more of an important member of the European Union than Greece. And so we might see Europe finally confronted with the fact that the Eurozone needs major change, and they could be forced into the position now where there's just no way around implementing that change.
Well, I'd like to get into the implications of that and what kind of changes might be in the offing that you're describing. But first, I'm intrigued by this, safety valve that Italy is at least talking about. If they can't get the help from the European Union or from Germany, they're talking about turning to Russia. Tell us about that.
Yeah, that is an interesting. I think Europe is about more divided on Russia than. Well, they've always been, but then pretty much they've ever been. And Russia's been very good, very clever with their divide and conquer that they've been playing here. So one of the things that Europe does continually is push up borrowing, finding ways of pushing up borrowing costs for nations that don't obey them. They got rid of a former Italian prime minister, Silvio Berlusconi, this way. They worked behind the scenes, and this is all documented now by U.S. Treasury Secretary, et cetera. They worked behind the scenes to make it more expensive for Italy to borrow money. And so Italy had no choice but to comply with Europe because they were going to go bankrupt if they didn't. This time around, Russia is stepping in there and basically saying, well, we'll lend you money cheaply. If Europe starts trying to tighten the screws, we'll give you cheap money, but we want you to undermine Europe's sanctions against Russia and start trying to open the door for Europe to move more closely to Russia. And when you start to now have, you've got Austria and you've got even Germany and some of these Central European countries more friendly to Russia, and then you've got Poland and Hungary and some of these Poland, Finland, some of these Eastern European Russians more against Russia, Russia's just been very successful at playing this kind of divide and rule.
Well, the relationships between European nations and Russia really are worth keeping an eye on. Maybe I can just drop a quick word in for the article that you have in this coming Trumpet edition about German-Russian relations. It kind of shows this broader historical perspective and how much of a push and pull there is between European nations and Russia. You focus on Germany and France, not Italy in that article, but it is quite extraordinary to view that history, and you can watch for that next week when that drops on thetrumpet.com as well. But returning to this impasse, this does show just how untenable the current situation is, and I guess the big takeaway from this is at some point there's going to have to be some fairly revolutionary changes in order to prevent this kind of problem from just wrecking the entire system.
Right, and where this gets really fascinating, I mean, if you look back at what Herbert W. Armstrong wrote about Europe and the way Europe is going to unite, he talked about a financial crisis and financial issues being a major part of what forces Europe to unite. And now we're faced with this situation where Europe is in this position where it's got reoccurring financial situations, crises, until it either they all go their separate ways and they divide, or they come together in something that's much more like a super state. And so you've got this financial pressure pushing Europe to come together, exactly the way Herbert W. Armstrong forecast. Mm-hmm. And part of the reason why he made that forecast is if you look at what the Bible says about this coming European power. I mean, you talked about Daniel 2 in the introduction there. Another place that talks a lot about this is Revelation 17 and Revelation 18. And there's a lot of stress in Revelation 18 about the economic side of this power. It talks about all the merchants of the earth mm-hmm. benefit from this coming European power. There's other scriptures that just talk about the trade that goes on here, the businesses that support this. Commerce is a major part of it. And so now you see this economic side of things forcing things through to a political union. You can really start to see, well, certainly what Mr. Armstrong said happening, and you can start to see those Bible prophecies now coming alive as you see this economic union. Now, the Bible talks a lot about major changes for Europe. There's Revelation 17 tells us what this European power would be like. It tells us that it will be made up with 10 nations. Like you said, Daniel 2 tells us there'll be this kind of united but divided aspect to these 10 nations. So we know from the Bible there's got to be major changes coming. And you see now a lot of economists for the last 7 or 8 years been looking at Europe and saying there's got to be major changes coming. They've got to shrink the Eurozone. 18 or 20, however many nations they've got right now in the Eurozone, that's too many. And whenever Europe has talked about shrinking down, they've always talked about something in the region of 10 nations. So you can really see now the path being prepared for this Europe, for this European nation that's described in the Bible.
Well, I think a really good place to look for more information about this would be our trend article about Europe's ongoing unification project. It does describe just how much the European Union coming together is predicated on exactly these kinds of crises forcing that unification. You can find that on thetrumpet.com under our trends section, and we'll put a link to that article in the show notes. Anything else that you might point people to, Richard?
Well, maybe just, we've been throwing out quite a lot of scriptures there. If you want to get just a really good grounding on what Revelation 17 means or Daniel 2, our free booklet, Who or What is the Prophetic Beast, is just a great place. I mean, that doesn't deal so much, say, with the world news aspect of things, but that would just give you a great biblical foundation to understand what's happening in Europe so that you can watch those scriptures in your Bible being proven true and just coming alive before your eyes.
All right. Thanks very much for that, Richard. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. It's time for the first of our stories about division in the United States. Democrats and leftists tried hard to prevent Brett Kavanaugh from being confirmed to the Supreme Court and failed. What will they do next? For this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, the longtime listeners of this program will be familiar with a very key Bible prophecy from Isaiah 3 that we watch for. And for those who aren't as familiar with it, the first 12 verses of that chapter almost describe like a domino effect of how the nation, America in this case, will fall into collapse. And the first domino to fall is that because of the sins of the people, God will take away the strong leaders from the nation. And then the second domino, because those leaders are gone, women and children will rise up to fill the vacuum. And when that happens, that's a sign of the desolation of the nation. It talks immediately after that verse about there being no bread in the land and the land lying desolate, talking about famine and other really deep problems like that. And so there's a development occurring in America right now that shows what step in this domino process we're at. Now, Judge Brett Kavanaugh, you brought him up earlier. He is actually one of the few like law-abiding, constitutional originalists left in the nation. And had a very stellar legal career for many decades, character never brought into reproach until about just a few days after he was nominated for the Supreme Court, in which case four women with a long history of supporting many of the abortion policies that Judge Kavanaugh is against came forward and accused him of sexual misconduct in either high school or college. As you mentioned, that they had a public prosecutor examine those claims, figuring that based off the evidence available, there was nothing to collaborate those accounts, and so the confirmation went ahead. Many like pro-feminist, pro-abortion activist groups were very livid that this happened. The Women's March, in particular, I think they've had up to like 300 people arrested in the demonstrations and the protests that they staged in their they had a couple of rallies. They had a Cancel Kavanaugh rally and a Shut Down Washington rally. And those didn't much hasn't come of those yet, but they've announced that on January 19th, they're scheduling another Women's March, one of the previous ones they had in protest against President Trump's election. Back in 2017 was actually the biggest protest movement in American history to that point. And so it seems like with this just zeal building over the Kavanaugh nomination, that the next one could be quite big as well. They had an article in Bazaar. It's like a women's fashion magazine, but I don't know how much this speaks for the Women's March movement as a whole. But the title was very inflammatory. It says, "With Kavanaugh confirmed, it's time to burn it down." And the quip being, "We will burn patriarchal institutions to the ground, and I pray that for our daughters, the blaze will light the way forward." So definitely some zeal building behind these marches, which shouldn't be completely discounted. Like I said for Bible prophecy, we were mentioned before that this is a sign that when you start seeing strong leaders taken away and women and children filling the void, that is, like I said, the next domino on the step to America's collapse. But even beyond that, I mean, people often forget that the Russian Revolution started with a women's march, where they had about 10,000 women come out to protest against the Tsar, and then eventually you had about 100,000 factory workers decide they were going to go support the women's movement. And one thing led to another. About 12 months later, the entire government had collapsed and was replaced with another form of government, replacing the Tsar with a communist dictatorship. French Revolution, similar. Didn't start with the women's march, but they did have a women's march for bread that really escalated the downfall of the king at that time. And so these type of events have a long history of collapsing governments, which is what the verse in Isaiah 3 is talking about the women and children ruling over them as the harbinger of the revolution that leads it to the land lying desolate and there being no bread in people's houses.
Well, it will definitely be interesting to watch here over the next couple of weeks as we come up to midterms. There's a record number of women who are running for office. There seems to be a very highly charged group of or representation among women who are much more favorable to Democrats than they are to Republicans, to see what kind of political effect that has, whether they get the political gains that they are hoping for. If they don't, then what kind of how that might further inflame their anger. There's a whole lot to stay attuned to here over the next couple of weeks in the United States. We appreciate that. Andrew, you're listening to Trumpet Hour. We'll take a short break. Coming up, we'll answer a few questions. How deep is the Trump administration's commitment to the state of Israel? What would happen if South Korea decided to end its military alliance with the U.S.? In Europe, is it okay to criticize the Prophet Muhammad for marrying a six-year-old? And do all these pipe bombs signal that America is closer to civil war? We'll be right back.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
U.S. President Donald Trump has laid down pretty tough policies on the Palestinians for their approach toward Israel. This week, he indicated he could get just as tough with Israel. For this story, we'll go back to Jerusalem and Brent Nachtigall.
Yeah, there's a really interesting report on Channel 10 here in Israel this week, which looked back at the UN General Assembly meeting that took place at the end of September and a conversation that took place between U.S. President Donald Trump and French President Emmanuel Macron. And apparently in that conversation that was leaked, but it was confirmed by four Western diplomats, Mr. Trump didn't seem that he was as favorable towards Israel as he's made out, at least in the sense of the peace negotiations. He has said in the past that, you know, I gave Israel something with the embassy move, and now I'm going to give the Palestinians something, so Israel should expect something that they're not going to like. And so it's more of this type of reporting, more of a leak that indicates that there is something coming for the Israelis that they're not going to like. And also the comments also indicated that he wasn't as didn't really believe in Netanyahu's ability to bring about peace, or his desire to bring about peace with a peace negotiation. I'll just give you a couple of quotes. This is what he said. This is Mr. Trump to Macron. I've given a lot to Netanyahu. I moved the embassy to Jerusalem. We give Israel $5 billion a year. I can be tough with Netanyahu on the peace plan, just like I've been tough with the Palestinians. And then he said, after Macron said to President Trump, I don't really know if he wants peace or if he'd rather the status quo. That's what Macron said. Mr. Trump returned a comment saying, you know, Emmanuel, I'm very close to reaching that same conclusion. And so that's the first indication we've seen that there is some daylight between Mr. Trump and Mr. Netanyahu. And so this is something that we are watching quite closely.
Well, for all that the president has done, to demonstrate his solidarity with the Israelis, there has been, I would say, a strain among the more realist analysts that have said, okay, at this point, he's making the demands on the Palestinians, but the way that he's giving these kind of concessions to the Israelis could indicate that at some point he's going to say there is going to be a price for this. And he's made some indications of this in the past, but this is a bit stronger than any indication that we've heard from before, isn't it?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think there's probably been two or three comments that he's made that you know, he started out giving things to Israel, and now he's going to give things to the Palestinians. And he did say that both won't be 100% happy with his peace plan, his idea for peace, but they're both going to have to make some concessions. The question we've wondered from the very beginning is Mr. Trump going to ask something of Israel that Israel, especially under the leadership of Mr. Netanyahu, that Israel is unwilling to give up? And in that way, is Israel going to be the impediment towards Mr. Trump achieving what he's called the deal of the century? And if that is the case, given the volatility of Mr. Trump, it may be that, you know, he is quite upset about Israel standing in the way of his achievement. We look at, you know, this relationship between the United States and Israel, the nation of Israel today, through what the Bible says about these two nations. And there's a prophecy in Zechariah chapter 11, and it talks about how there's going to be a breaking of this brotherhood between the United States and Israel. And the brotherhood is going to break, you know, in this underneath this administration. And so this is possibly one way that we can see the two splitting. If people want to read up about this breaking of the brotherhood of this relationship, an article by Mr. Stephen Flurry entitled Band of Brothers.
Well, there has been quite a bit of talk of Donald Trump bringing a new Middle East peace plan to the table here within the next couple of months. And if this gives any indication as to what sort of demands that he might make or what kind of concessions he might expect from the Israelis, it will certainly be interesting to watch the direction that takes. We appreciate that very much, Brent. Another strong American alliance whose strength is being called into question is that with South Korea. To learn about this, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, there are more and more signs showing that the U.S. and South Korea are going in different directions regarding North Korea. One big indication of this came early last month when South Korea opened up a liaison office with North Korea. That was despite U.S. opposition. And then just a few days after that, South Korea's foreign minister publicly rebuked Washington for being inflexible with some of the good faith measures that North Korea has asked the U.S. to take. And then also last month, South Korea said it was thinking about removing some of the sanctions on North Korea. U.S. President Donald Trump was adamantly opposed to that. Right now, he's still trying to apply maximum pressure until there's verifiable and total evidence that the North has denuclearized. So he actually said, South Korea does nothing without our approval. The South Korean public, yeah, they were very riled by the notion that they're just, right. You know, sort of a puppet of Washington. And then this month, South Korea said it's forging ahead with plans to open up roads and railways to North Korea, even though the U.S. is urging them to delay that. And then South Korea and North Korea are also working to implement no-fly zone over the demilitarized zone in between the two countries. But the most significant development was on October 12th, when South Korea's military chief vowed to shift command of the South Korean military from Washington, which has had command of it since the Korean War, to Seoul. So he says, you know, it's our military. We're tired of this model that puts America in charge of it. So these are all clear signs that Washington and South Korea are finding it just more and more difficult to stick to the same playbook mm-hmm. on North Korea. And Geopolitical Futures wrote about this on Monday. And they said, quote, in the case of the U.S. and South Korea, the strategic logic is starting to crack. And South Korea has little choice but to defy Washington where it must to prepare for the day when it may have to strike out on its own. Mm-hmm. So these analysts at Geopolitical Futures really feel like this divergence that we're seeing between South Korea and the U.S. could lead to a rupture in that alliance that's been such a pillar mm-hmm. to America's strategy to keep Asia stable for so many decades.
Right. You could definitely see that changing the whole balance of power in Asia and America's influence in that region. Looked at from the standpoint of Bible prophecy, though, it's not all of that surprising that we would be seeing that.
It's really not surprising at all. This is a very sobering possibility. If this rupture were to happen, you know, it could trigger a whole domino effect, I think, with nations like Japan, who also rely on the U.S. They could say, you know, we need to start to push to develop and enhance our own military capabilities as well. It's sobering, but as you said, in terms of Bible prophecy, it's not at all surprising. This is something that The Trumpet and our forerunner magazine, The Plain Truth, under Mr. Herbert W. Armstrong, have actually said would happen for decades, because Bible prophecy is very clear that in the end time, God would break the pride in America's power, and the U.S. would see its power decline in Asia and everywhere else. That's in Leviticus 26 and other Bible passages. And Bible prophecy also shows that as that's happening, the Asian nations will rise up to become much more powerful and even unified eventually during an age that the Bible calls the times of the Gentiles. That's the phrase that Jesus Christ himself used in Luke 21, verse 24. And we've already seen this shift happening gradually for years and years. It's been well underway for quite a long time. And if Geopolitical Futures is right about a rupture, you know, on the horizon in the U.S. security, in the U.S.-South Korea military alliance, then that would just be another major step in that direction. Mm-hmm. And I would encourage listeners to order a free copy of our booklet, Russia and China in Prophecy. This goes through all of these Bible prophecies that talk about both the decline of the U.S. in Asia and everywhere else, and the rise of Asian nations. And it just goes through those prophecies and the geopolitical trends, and it shows how this tectonic shift is well underway. But it also shows that as frightening as it is to watch that, there's some very, very good news at the end.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, thanks for that, Jeremiah. An interesting story out of Europe. A woman made some statements she says are protected by freedom of speech. A European court says no, what she said violates freedom of religion. For this, we'll go back to Richard Palmer.
Yes, we have an interesting story and a very controversial story from Austria this week. There was a woman there who was giving a seminar on Islam in 2009. And in that seminar, she was talking about the fact that Muhammad married a six-year-old girl. This is what's taught in the official Islamic texts, though they say that he didn't sleep with her until she was nine. And during that speech, she said, a 56-year-old and a six-year-old, what do you call that? Give me an example. What do we call it if it's not pedophilia? So, and then Austria fined her for that. It was a choice between, I think, about a 500 euro fine or jail. She appealed. It went all the way to the European Court of Human Rights because she said, look, it's right there in the European Convention on Human Rights. It says I have a right to free speech. And the European Court of Human Rights said, no, you can't say that. I mean, this is despite the fact that this woman, I mean, she's right. Muhammad right. was a pedophile. I mean, there's no real way around that. But the court ruled. Well, they did two things. Firstly, they kind of pulled out the small print of the medical definition of pedophilia, which in that it says somebody who's predominantly attracted to children. And I think something like 91% of Muhammad's wives were not children. So they said technically, according to the small print, he was not a pedophile. And they also said that she failed to talk about the culture surround and the historical context, which is basically the argument that, well, everybody's doing it, therefore it's fine, which still makes it pedophilia. And you try that argument with slavery, and it falls apart very quickly. Mm-hmm. Everybody's enslaving people, therefore it's fine. Not a great mm-hmm. way of justifying things historically. So just this bizarre ruling from the European Court of Human Rights, but I think it illustrates an important point. You know, here at the Trumpet a lot, we talk about the rise of Europe, and we say, you know, Europe's rising, Europe's going to challenge America for dominance of the world. And it would be pretty easy in the United States to kind of sit back and look about that and say, you know, well, why do I care? Why is that a big problem? Europe's pretty similar to the United States. We have the same values. They're going to be on our side. And then you get something like this from Europe that, to, I think, especially America with its protection of free speech, but also Britain with that same kind of heritage of protection of free speech, is just bizarre. And it does illustrate the point that Europe actually does have very different values, very different cultural background. There is not the same value and heritage and history of free speech. And so in a world where Europe is leading and where Europe is at the head, it's going to have a very different character to the United States right now, or to a world where the United States is the superpower. And you know, right now, this particular ruling, it defends Muhammad and it defends Muslims. They're not going to always be that way. But Europe just does not have that same tradition of freedom that we have in Britain and America. And a world led by Europe is going to be a very different place.
Yeah, you know, I guess another way of looking at it is we do see the same kind of limits being put on free speech within Britain and America as well. And we're sacrificing those freedoms in the name of protections for Muslims and other what are minority groups within these countries. Political correctness is prescribing those freedoms within these countries. But the other thing too is I would expect that there would be, given the climate of backlash against immigration, against Muslim incursion within Europe, that there would be some there would be a lot of frustration and anger over this type of a ruling, and showing that this whole these protections that have been placed to prevent people from speaking out or even stating open facts about this religion have run amok, and that they need to be challenged. That I would imagine that there would even be some politicians who would say, well, that's just not right. We need to do something different. Not to take away the point about just how there is a bit more of a, I guess, an authoritarian tack or bent within Europe when it comes to this type of thing. But you could see this breaking in a couple of different directions. It is extraordinary to see the way that that they handled that situation, and how we are in a climate where it's just less and less okay to say things that are patently true.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm glad you mentioned that point, because you look at where this is coming from. It's coming from Austria, where they've got a far right government or country that's part of the government. And it's exactly these kind of rulings that led to that.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I think that's a great aspect of the story as well, that you are seeing this backlash against the way that Europe has been pandering to Islam in these very ridiculous ways. And that is something that's going to change the climate of Europe.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, we appreciate that, Richard. We'll finish by talking about this series of pipe bomb packages in the United States. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, throughout this week, a series of pipe bombs have showed up at the homes and offices of prominent Democrats. There is one to the showed up to the address of George Soros, another to the address of Bill and Hillary Clinton. Congressman Maxine Waters received one. Former President Barack Obama received one. Former CIA Director John Brennan and former Attorney General Eric Holder. Even one that was supposed to go to former Vice President Joe Biden, that was actually, it didn't go through. It got like a return to sender protocol in the post office. But obviously this is big in the news this week, with you have bombs being sent to all these prominent Democratic and liberal leaders. No clue yet as to who sent the bombs, whether this is some foreign agent, whether it's domestic, what political party. These are all things that are still a mystery, but that certainly hasn't stopped people from both sides of the political aisle from putting forward their opinion right on this, with even up to MSNBC news anchors on public television saying that, like, well, this is obviously someone who reads the Drudge Report, or this is obviously someone who reads Fox News. This is obviously someone who's been influenced by the inflammatory rhetoric of President Donald Trump, which is definitely an irony to that, because those statements themselves are inflammatory rhetoric being based off something that has no proof yet, trying to blame, well, this is obviously a conservative because the bombs were sent to liberal leaders. You've seen the same thing on among some conservatives, not really conservative leaders. Conservative leaders have done a much better job of shutting up until the facts come out. But amongst like people on Twitter and stuff like that, about theories that could be true, but no proof of them yet, that like, well, this is obviously a liberal who sent bombs that they knew weren't going to go off to their fellow liberal leaders as like a false flag thing to try to make conservatives look violent to influence the midterm election.
Mm-hmm.
There's no evidence of it.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and both ways, though, it just does highlight the deep division in America. This is one of the first elections, I think, one of I can remember where you've had like bomb threats, or at least alleged bomb threats with high-ranking profiles like this. And it wouldn't be shocking. I don't think anyone who's listening here shocking to hear like a bomb going off in a political leader's office in the type of climate we are today, because it's certain polls say a third of Americans think that a civil war is likely within the next 5 years. I don't think anyone would be surprised by a bomb going off in someone's office with the tensions running as high as they are in America. And that's something, again, that longtime listeners of this show will know that is a prophecy as well. Ezekiel 5 in particular, verses 7 through 10. I guess any of our listeners can look at that later if they want to. But it talks about God saying, it says, because you've sinned more than all the nations around you, I will be against you. And even like fathers will eat their sons in the midst of you, and sons will eat their fathers. So this is talking about like domestic turmoil, domestic, I mean, father against son, famines and things like that, that would prompt even cannibalism, which for anyone interested in more of the details on that, our editor-in-chief has a booklet, Ezekiel, the End Time Prophet, that has a chapter that goes through the pestilence of Ezekiel 5 in great detail.
Okay, well, that's going to have to do it for the program today. Thanks for that, Andrew. I'm Joel Hilliker. Visit the Trumpet Hour Hub on thetrumpet.com for links to all the articles and literature that we talked about on the program today. You can email us your thoughts to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal.
Pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks to our staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with the words of Soren Kierkegaard. Life can be understood backwards, but it must be lived forwards. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.